Does a moderate candidate really have the best chance of capturing the presidency for the Democratic Party?
If, you know, more than 50% of the country is willing to tell a pollster that they would vote for a Democratic Socialist for president, then that really calls into question the centrist claim that a pretty standard issue progressive would be unable to garner more than 50%. If you look at polling around questions like universal health care or Medicare for all or a Green New Deal or $15 minimum wage or free college and on, you find that you have, you know, majority support among independents and significant support even among Republicans.
That's Ryan Grimm of The Intercept. We talk with him about his fascinating new book, We've Got People, from Jesse Jackson to AOC, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. Then we check in with Nation editor Jeet Heer about his take on the state of the Democratic Party after the last debate. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. On Saturday, October 19th, an estimated 26,000 people, plus another 5,000 in the overflow crowd, came to the giant Bernie Sanders rally at Queensbridge Park in New York. It was the largest political rally so far of the 2020 Democratic presidential campaign. The runner-up was the giant Elizabeth Warren rally earlier this year in Manhattan, some 20,000. Clearly, there's big support in New York City for progressive change. What about the rest of the country? Well, Sanders and Warren, neither of whom accept corporate PAC money, are leading in small-dollar donations. In fact, donations averaging just $18 have put Bernie Sanders at the head of the pack in overall money raised among the Democratic candidates. And large majorities of all voters support signature progressive policies like free public college tuition, canceling student debt, Medicare for all, and a $15 minimum wage. Ditto for the Green New Deal, introduced into Congress by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey. AOC may seem like she came from nowhere, but the movement that propelled her to office and to global political stardom has been building for 30 years. Even before the 2016 campaign of Bernie Sanders that personally inspired her to get into politics. Ryan Grimm's book, We've Got People, is the story of that movement. It first exploded into public view with a largely forgotten presidential run of Reverend Jesse Jackson, a campaign that came close to winning. With the party and the nation now at a crossroads, We've Got People offers new insight into how the Democratic Party and the progressive movement have gotten where they are and where they're headed. Ryan Grimm is former Washington bureau chief for Huffington Post and currently for The Intercept. He's a political commentator for the Young Turks and has written for Rolling Stone, The Washington Post, and Politico. Ryan Grimm, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, this was just a terrific book. And the title, We've Got People, comes from something that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said. They've got money, we've got people, which I think sums up beautifully the core message of the book. You say in the book that the Democratic Party is far more divided at the top than it is at the bottom. And I wonder what you mean by that.
So there is a tendency among the media and also among a lot of observers and regular people, because they have tended to kind of punditize themselves, to look at the Democratic Party, look at Democratic Party voters and split them into camps of these are the Hillary Clinton people and these are the Bernie Sanders people, or now these are the Sanders people, these are the Warren people, and these are the Joe Biden people. And to believe that they have kind of fundamentally different worldviews that are competing, using these candidates as kind of vehicles for that competition. When if you actually talk to a lot of these people who are supporting each of the candidates, the reasons that they've chosen those individual candidates tend not to have a ton to do with their view of politics or ideology necessarily. It comes down to other characteristics. Whether they trust them, they're a good leader, they can beat Trump. You know, they'll do well in the Rust Belt. You know, what a lot of other factors. But when you ask them, you know, where they stand on universal health care or a $15 minimum wage or a Green New Deal, you find close to universal agreement among those people. You know, so they're divided over, you know, who might be best to execute the Democratic vision, but fundamentally they're united around the same kind of progressive agenda. And that's kind of what I mean by the party's more divided at the top than it is at the bottom.
And it seems that that is so key, because it's not really a fight. You're saying really it's not a fight over the values when it comes to the base, the Democratic base, the people that we talk about. We've got people. That it's, you know, as many people have said, a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. The allegiance, are they going to have allegiance to their base or allegiance to their donors?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's very hard to have a kind of a clean conversation about where the party should head when there are so many people with vested interests in it not heading in the progressive direction that Democratic people, Democratic voters want it to. And they have access to the level of resources that they're able to distort the conversation in a very impressive way.
I think a lot of people then would counter with saying, well, the base is not, you know, you can win the base, but then you're not going to win the general election. The idea is that the general electorate is more centrist, is going to respond to the centrist ideas. I think that seems to be the key of their defense of not listening to some of the more progressive aspects of the base. What's your sense of that?
Well, you could make a couple points about that. One would be you could point to the fact that Bernie Sanders, all through 2015 and 2016, actually polled higher in head-to-heads against Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton did. It's a little less true in the wake of the heart attack that Bernie Sanders had recently, but up until recently, it was true that Bernie Sanders was still polling, you know, in a head-to-head matchup with Trump, you know, even better than Joe Biden in a lot of cases. And this is a person who is an avowed democratic socialist. If, you know, more than 50% of the country is willing to tell a pollster that they would vote for a democratic socialist for president, then that really calls into question the centrist claim that a pretty standard issue progressive would be unable to garner more than 50%. You know, a lot of it comes down to who the person is, you know, how good they are on the stump, and you know how much charisma they have, how trustworthy they are. You know, all of those things that go into people's decision making. But if you look at polling around questions like universal health care or Medicare for all or a Green New Deal or $15 minimum wage or free college and on, you find that you have, you know, majority support among independents and significant support even among Republicans. So it's not a question of popularity. What the more sophisticated people mean when they say that you would lose a general election if you tried to run on, you know, a thoroughly populist agenda that really attacked corporate power, is that the corporate power under attack would spend so much money defeating you and not necessarily running ads saying defend corporate power. You know, they would spend their money in a much more sophisticated fashion, digging up opposition research and otherwise attacking you from different angles, that under that fusillade of spending you would fall. So that's what the more savvy and cynical consultants would say about why an anti-corporate progressive agenda can't succeed. Not that it's unpopular, not that put up against its alternative, it wouldn't win more than 50%, but that you couldn't have a clean fight because there'd be so much money spent against you that it would be hopeless.
Yeah. And so that gets back to the heart of your book, which is in a way that what equalizes against the money is the popular support for these. And before we get into the book itself, just to follow up on what you just said, what's your sense of that? Do you think we could, that the We've Got People can overwhelm those messages? And what would it count on to be able to do that?
Well, a lot would have to come together at the same time. But you may have that at the moment. You know, you'd have to have a deeply unpopular alternative, which exists right now in the form of Donald Trump. You'd have to have an unimpressive kind of center-left establishment candidate running in the primary, who's just impressive enough that they take up all the oxygen from the other ones. And you have that in the form of Joe Biden right now, who's taking up oxygen from people like Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg and Beto O'Rourke. And then you'd have to have one or two talented, you know, principled people on the left who can appeal to the entire party. And you have that with Warren and potentially with Sanders, but you know, you're more and more seeing it with Warren. And so, you know, kind of all of those things, I think, have to exist at the same time. If there was a Barack Obama level candidate running on the center left, then I don't think there's room for Warren. Mm-hmm. If Mitt Romney is president, you know, you probably can't elect somebody like Warren. I don't know. But you know, with all of these things in place, it sets up a situation where something out of the ordinary could actually.
So you start the book, Ryan Grimm, you start this book, We've Got People, in 2010, during the depths of the Great Recession, at a party in a bar. And this party is being held by Joseph Crowley, who was famously defeated in a landslide by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He was a New Democrat, socially liberal, but a blue dog Democrat. And then there was somebody else there, Raul Grijalva. So talk about the contrast between these two candidates. And did you had a conversation with Grijalva there?
I did, yes. And Grijalva, this was the bar is called the Tune In. This was Grijalva's regular haunt. And it's a place that's sort of off the beaten path. And it was very unusual that all of these Democratic members of Congress were partying in this bar that night, and the night that the Affordable Care Act passed. And Grijalva was not invited. He was just there coincidentally. And so he's looking as his bar is being taken over by his colleagues. It's a completely raucous affair with Crowley behind the bar, pouring shots, leading toasts, you know, singing songs in the Irish Paul fashion that he's so good at. And I asked Grijalva how he was feeling, and he said, we're celebrating and we're commiserating. And, you know, what he was hinting at was the weakness that was embedded in the Affordable Care Act. He's the chairman at the time of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, a former migrant labor organizer from Arizona. He and many others felt like the window for vast change had opened in the same way that it opened in the 1930s, opened again in the 1960s, and that this was going to be the moment where Democrats kind of completed the work of the New Deal and the Great Society. And they felt like they had muscled through a meager reform, and they were glad that they had done so because it would bring relief to more than 20 million people would get insurance. People who had pre-existing conditions could breathe easier, knowing that they couldn't be denied if they lost their coverage. But it was falling extremely short of the ambitions that they had for the party, and they were lamenting the missed opportunity and also the potential blowback for missing the opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. So take us through the fight over the public option, you know, something which now is the moderate position on the Democratic.
That's the sellout position now, yeah.
Yeah. So tell us what happened. Who was involved? How did the public option, I mean, I remember following it at the time and you know, thinking that, oh, my God, they'll never do a public option. And in fact, I was right. But it actually almost succeeded. So bring us through a little bit of that history.
Yeah, and it starts in a way with, I mean, obviously it starts with the kind of progressive push for public healthcare, but it starts specifically with John Edwards, of all people, who was the vice presidential nominee in 2004 and then ran for president in 2008 as kind of the leftmost viable candidate in that race. So it was kind of a three-person race of Edwards, Obama, and Clinton. And I think a lot of people forget Hillary Clinton finished third in Iowa. She didn't even finish. Everybody knows she lost to Obama. People don't realize she lost to Edwards too. And so Edwards, at a healthcare forum organized by the Center for American Progress, showed up with this thoroughly detailed healthcare reform plan, which had as its centerpiece a public option. Clinton's did not have that, and Obama didn't even show up with a plan, and he left kind of humiliated. It was one of his first big setbacks of the campaign, and he quickly, you know, ordered his staff to put together a thorough plan, and they basically just copied and pasted Edwards' plan. And so that became the standard around which people rallied, and the decision of, you know, which path on reform to take if they won the White House was essentially made at that point. And so the public option stayed in the healthcare plans. It made it all the way through the House of Representatives, was passed by the House, though it was significantly watered down, but it was traded away in the Senate. And the White House kept giving off signals that look, Obama called it a sliver of reform. He said, it's just a sliver of reform. You know, he was very frustrated by how much importance people were putting around the idea of the public option. And at one point he said, you know, this wasn't even something that we ran on. This wasn't supposed to be a big part of healthcare reform. And as I write about in the book, the group, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, took out a full-page ad in the New York Times signed by hundreds of staff and volunteers for the Obama campaign saying, no, quite the opposite. We absolutely did campaign for this, and it is something that's extremely important for us. But so it got traded away. But then when Scott Brown, the Republican senator, when Scott Brown running for Ted Kennedy's open seat, Ted Kennedy passed away, won this stunning special election, all of a sudden the music stops. And they had passed through the Senate with 60 votes an imperfect version of the Affordable Care Act. There was the House version, and the plan was to conference these two together, and then they were going to move them back through Congress. They couldn't do that anymore with Scott Brown vowing to oppose anything that they were going to try to do. And so without 60 votes, now they're stuck. And so Rahm Emanuel says, well, let's give up. You know, it's over. Like, the people have spoken. Let's expand health care for children. And Nancy Pelosi derides it as kiddie care. She says, we're not doing kiddie care. We're doing the whole thing. And in order to get some momentum going, a pair of freshman House members, Shelley Pingree and Jared Polis — Polis is now governor of Colorado, Pingree is still a member of Congress — they put together a letter and said, look, if you're going to push the bill through the Senate on a 50 vote threshold, because you're going to now use rules known as budget reconciliation, then put a public option in it. You know, the whole time you've been telling us that the reason we can't have a public option is that it doesn't have 60 votes in the Senate. We already passed it through the House. Now you don't need 60 votes in the Senate. You only need 50. So put the public option in. And the letter started picking up dozens and dozens and dozens of signatures on the House side. And then four senators over on the Senate side signed a similar letter to Harry Reid saying, let's do this. And eventually more than 40 senators signed it, and more than 50 committed that if they would put the public option on the Senate floor, that they would vote for it. And the White House was livid. As it was described to me, too many promises had been made. Too many deals with industry had been made that the public, they thought the public option was completely done. And in the end, they didn't put it on the floor. For a brief moment, they had a deal where in exchange for dropping the public option, they would lower the Medicare age down to 55, which today would be a huge sellout compromise position. But at the time would have been huge, particularly as so many hundreds of thousands or millions of people in their 50s and 60s were out of work because of the Great Recession, and they were facing age discrimination and unable to find work. And so here they are, they're 55, 56 years old, wondering if they're ever going to work again. And they're also uninsured and just waiting. They have 10 years before they can get into Medicare. That would have been a lifeline. That would have saved a lot of lives. Joe Lieberman came out against it, said he absolutely would vote against anything that had anything like that in it. Rahm Emanuel eventually told Harry Reid, just get it done. Just push it through. And they ended up pushing it through without the public option. And you've seen the public option advocates said, look, if you have a Medicare-like plan in the exchanges competing with all these private plans, you're going to keep costs down. You're going to keep premiums, deductibles, et cetera, down, because they won't be able to just run away with your money. Without that included, what you have seen has been these, you know, runaway premiums. It now costs the American family something like $20,000 a year for health insurance. So that's a cost of a new car every single year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I actually call it the Unaffordable Care Act. So let me ask you, what was the impact? What was the fallout, do you feel? Because, you know, Obama had this majority, the House, he had the Senate, the presidency, the Democrats had it all, and they lost the Congress in the midterm elections. Is there a connection?
I think there is. You have to throw in other things too. And, you know, foremost among them is the economy and the Democratic response to it. Obama brought in so many people connected to Wall Street and didn't prosecute anybody from Wall Street, didn't do anything about the foreclosure crisis. They very consciously thought that it was bad policy to try to do anything about the foreclosure crisis. They said that they should just let it take its course. That it set the stage for people to feel like the administration was not fighting for people. Instead, it was in the pocket of banks. And so then when you had the AIG bonus scandal, you know, where after AIG gets bailed out with tens of billions of dollars, they give massive bonuses to all of their executives. And that just set the American people off. And it made it so that rather than Bush owning the disaster, now the Obama administration very much owned it. And at the same time, they moderated what they thought they could get done with the stimulus. They did not use their capital that they built up during the campaign. They didn't use their grassroots movement that they had organized to pressure Congress to do a much bigger stimulus. And their economists knew that the stimulus that they were doing in early 2009 was not enough to dig them out of the hole. And so when November 2010 came around, unemployment was still at 10%, and the banks were doing great, and the foreclosure crisis was ripping through neighborhoods. And so you couple that with healthcare, which freaks people out and made a lot of people mad, and it led to this, them getting swept out of power.
Now, the Democrats lost nearly 1,000 seats in the run-up to 2016, although I think it probably took a longer period of time than just since Obama's election. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said that a big piece of the election of Donald Trump, as you write in the book, Ryan Grimm, as you write in We've Got People, she said that that a lot of the election had to do with the resentment that these people have no clue what's affordable and what's not. They think their half measures are good enough when working people are drowning. It's the same with climate. It's the same with education. So these issues are not really separate issues. You know, healthcare, climate, education. Talk about the connections that people began to start making. When did they begin to start making the connections between these different issues to a more comprehensive critique of the system? In other words, when did people start thinking that the problem was capitalism or Wall Street?
Well, I think it was the financial crisis that brought that about. And not just that. So, you know, in the Soviet Union and the end of, you know, the Berlin Wall falls in 89, the Soviet Union falls in 91. You know, if you were raised before then, there wasn't a whole lot of cachet or romanticism about socialism. And so, you know, by 2008, you're now 17 years removed from that. And you're being told that the only possible alternative to socialism is capitalism. It's the inevitable way that human society has to be structured. And then you see the biggest banks in the world completely insolvent, on the brink of collapse, and only rescued by the state, by a bailout from the people. And you see that create stagnation and recession for years on end. You see it start to create an authoritarian populist rise around the world. And it becomes very easy for people to, young people particularly, to say, I'm not so sure that this is the best system that could possibly be on offer.
Yeah, and you also talk about ways in which this isn't just young people of, say, a liberal bent, although that's important too, but that, you know, there's a lot of talk about working class voters as if working class voters are the centrists. And you have a very interesting footnote on page 32 of We've Got People. You say that working class voters actually need to be separated into two camps, evangelicals and non-evangelicals. Talk more about that. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, and I don't understand why pollsters won't just do it, because it is so thoroughly established in the political science literature that it's not even one of the things that's up for debate anymore. It just is. Everybody from right to left agrees that if you talk monolithically about white working class or white non-college, as pollsters like to call them, you're talking in too broad a term to say anything meaningful. Because if you pull out evangelical white voters from the overall universe of white voters, then the behavior and the voting patterns of the rest of the white voters look radically different. You still will find, stronger support for Democrats, for instance, among black voters than among non-evangelical white voters. It's not even close. But you find them to be much more democratic, much more receptive to progressive ideas than the stereotype that exists of them as just thoroughly kind of irredeemable and deplorable. When in fact, the numbers among evangelicals are off the charts. You know, they are nearly as Republican as black voters are Democratic. And so that, dramatically distorts the overall picture of white voters. And it's useful to understand that because those evangelical voters tend to be, concentrated in the South. Their numbers are shrinking as a proportion of the population. And so, you can learn a lot about the electorate, and it can inform your decision making when you're thinking about, policy ideas and organizing, if you just understand it at that. And it's not even that granular a level. It's just one level further down.
Ryan Grimm, author of We've Got People. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Now, let's get back to my conversation with Ryan Grimm about his book, We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to AOC, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. Ryan Grimm, let's move to talking about maybe the tactics or strategy, not sure which, the difference between We've Got People and They've Got Money. You talk about, distributed campaigning, distributive campaigning. I'm not sure what the term is exactly. I mean, I think we all have a general sense of the difference between reliance on large donors versus reliance on small donors. But this has really been a revolution in campaigning. Talk about how did this come about, and what are some of the key or most important characteristics of the difference?
Yeah, they call it distributed. And what they mean by that is they mean empowering volunteers and empowering grassroots, distributing organizing power from the top down to the bottom. And it was tested out by the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016 in a not terribly systematic way at first, but by a group of organizers who figured out a way to create space within the campaign to try out a new organizing tactic. And it was rooted around the insight, the people who were supporting Bernie Sanders were willing to give more than money. You know, the $27 that they were giving on average was terrific, and it was fueling the campaign. But a lot of these people had time, energy, and talent that they were willing to donate toward the campaign. And then the question was, could the campaign build some type of apparatus whereby volunteers could channel their energy in a productive way, rather than the example of the kind of not necessarily totally productive use of time would be what's called a honking wave. You know, you get a couple friends, you go to a street corner, you go to a bridge, you hold up a sign and you wave at people and they honk at you. You know, that'll get name recognition out there. It's a show of support. It's not useless, but it's not organizing. It's not building anything. It's not making contacts with specific voters, having conversations with them, persuading them, and then registering that information that you're getting so that you're more organized for the next time that you go and have that conversation with that person and try to get them to go vote or go to a rally or whatever you want them to do. And so that was their challenge through much of 2016. And as one of the organizers described it to me, you know, just as they were taking off, they ran out of runway. They only made their millionth phone call, I think, by the end of January. By which point the race was effectively over because the superdelegate lead was so great that a come from behind win was going to be almost impossible for Sanders. But this time, you know, they've had the 4 years since then to get prepared, and you know, they just did an effort where they made a million calls in 10 days. That's September bleeding into October of 2019. So we're, you know, 4 months out from the first voting. So it's trying to demonstrate what is possible, what volunteers are capable of, because the traditional approach that campaigns take toward volunteers is give us money and that's about it. You know, they get nervous about putting them to use because they don't quite know how to do it. They don't quite trust them to not embarrass them. You're taking a risk by trusting in people. But in some ways the tactic flows from your ideology. You know, the people like Sanders believe that the people that's where the power ought to reside. So they're more willing to distribute power there during the campaign as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have to, in full disclosure, say I was part of that volunteer group that did the phone calling in that week where they tried to get a million calls.
Oh, cool. How was it? How many calls do you think you made?
I'd say I made about 150 calls. I'd say, I mean, the number of people that you actually get to talk with is probably pretty low. I'd say, you know, maybe.
People say about 1 in 10. Does that sound about right?
Yes, it is about 1 in 10. But the conversations that I had were very interesting because I mean, of the people that I reached, most of them were checked out of the political process. And after talking with them, you know, they were kind of like, my vote doesn't count. And I have to say, I mean, I don't know if they'll go to the polls, but after talking with them, it really seemed as if they just needed a little push to believe that their vote could count. And by the end of the call, they seemed much more enthusiastic. I mean, those were the most, you know, both interesting and satisfying calls I made. So the whole point that I think you make in this book, Ryan Grimm, that you make in We've Got People, is that the key is to expand the number of people who are voting rather than depend on the reliable voters. And so I wonder if you could weigh in on that.
Yeah, that starts with Jesse Jackson's 1984 and then 88 presidential campaign, where he, in 88, he talks about how Reagan won re-election and he lists off the number of votes that he won all of these different states by, and it's far, far less than the number of unregistered students or the number of unregistered Black voters and unregistered Hispanic voters. And Jackson makes that case that if the way to build a majority party in this country is to just relentlessly go out and find those people and convince them to vote. And one of the people I interviewed for the book, Claire Sandberg, said she thinks about turnout as persuasion. And so what she means by that is that in field organizing and in campaigns, people talk about there are kind of two lanes of activity. On the one hand is persuasion. The other hand is turnout. And persuasion is where you know that somebody's going to vote. They, you just don't know who they're going to vote for yet. And so your job is through television ads, door knocking or radio ads, mailers, is to persuade them that they should vote for your candidate. And then when it comes to people who you're not sure if they're going to vote, that's turnout. You make sure that they turn out to the polls, and you do that through mostly through door knocking and sometimes through mailers. What she says is that, in fact, for the kinds of voters that Sanders is trying to reach, that turnout is persuasion. In other words, like you said, you have to do what you did on the phone. You have to persuade people that there's a point to them turning out. It's not that they don't necessarily know where their polling place is and don't know how to do it. You know, sure, they may need a little help on that front. And certainly it's difficult for a lot of working people to get the time to go out and vote. But fundamentally, for many, 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 many people, they actually are not persuaded that there's a point. And you have to meet them where they are. You have to not shame them about that, because you have to recognize that they are making a valid point. You know, if you go back throughout history, well, first of all, the first valid point they're making is that the chance that their individual vote actually matters is almost infinitesimally small. There was one race in Virginia, the Virginia legislature, that hinged on one single vote. You know, so for an individual person, you can understand it from their perspective. But then more broadly, yeah, the Democrats were in power in the 90s, then from 2009 on, wages got a little bit better under Democrats. Clinton also signed NAFTA. And, you know, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in the 30 years from the 80s to the 2000s were not terribly distinguishable. Now, certainly on a lot of important issues to a lot of important people, they are. I'm not saying that they're identical parties, but from someone not following it terribly closely, you're not really seeing either of the parties out there fighting for you. And so I think you have to meet those non-voters where they are, say, okay, I understand why you would say that. In fact, I agree with most of that analysis, but here's why it's different this time, and try to work to persuade them. And so I think that that's a key insight from Sandberg, that in fact, turnout is not just turnout. Turnout is actually persuasion. You have to persuade somebody that there's a point to it.
Exactly. And after the 2016 election, there was a struggle over who was going to be the head of the DNC between Keith Ellison. Well, Keith Ellison, actually, it looked like he was going to become the chair of the DNC. What happened? Why did Tom Perez come in? So talk about the election for the DNC and what you felt happened there, or what actually happened there, and what do you think has been the impact?
Well, it was interesting. Out of the gate, the party establishment seemed to want to do a makeup call to the Sanders wing. And immediately after Keith Ellison, who had been one of the few people to endorse Sanders as an elected official, won the endorsement of not only Sanders, not only Warren, but Chuck Schumer, and then Randy Weingarten, who'd been, you know, one of Hillary Clinton's kind of loudest surrogates on the campaign trail. And Schumer and Weingarten jumping in early for Ellison seemed to be a signal that, okay, look, we're going to give the Sanders wing this one. You know, we won the primary. Our candidate ran in the general election, and we lost to Donald Trump. So let's have a little bit of humility here and work with the other wing of the party. And no, it's not the biggest position on the planet, the DNC chair. You know, it's bureaucratic in a lot of ways. I think the left actually probably puts way too much stock in the DNC chair's ability to do much. Now, you know, you can certainly put your thumb on your scale here and there, and they did in 2016, particularly in the way that they set up the fundraising agreement with Clinton, but then they also scheduled as few debates as possible, and they scheduled them all at the times when the fewest people would be watching, which is an advantage to somebody who has 100% name ID running against someone like Sanders, who you have to remember came into that race with like a 5% name ID. Nobody'd heard of this gadfly senator from Vermont. But beyond that, it's a not exactly ceremonial position, but it's close. And so the party bosses were like, you know what? Okay, let's let Keith Ellison take this. But then Obama intervened. The Obama administration are not fans of Keith Ellison. And they went out and they recruited Tom Perez, which I think was a huge mistake for Perez too. He was planning on running for governor of Maryland in 2018. And instead they talked him into running for DNC chair instead. He didn't, you know, have the kind of experience that would have set him up to succeed. With enough arm twisting, they were able to muscle Perez just barely across the finish line and elect him DNC chair. And I report in the book that, you know, with all of these internal party elections, there's all kinds of shenanigans that go on. But one of the shenanigans that went on was Republicans on the island of Puerto Rico basically pulled off a coup and took over the Democratic Party in Puerto Rico and then went to Perez. And these were pro-statehood Republicans. They went to Perez and said, if you endorse statehood, we will give you all of Puerto Rico's delegates. And the Puerto Ricans and the New Yorkers have a lot of alliances, particularly with Cuomo's wing of it, and combined the might of the Cuomo wing of the New York delegation and the Puerto Rican delegation put Perez over the top. The DNC had never had a position on statehood before. Part of that's just for fundraising. You know, the island is split on the issue. And what's the point of taking a position if you're going to alienate half the rich people in Puerto Rico? But the other reason is that the idea around Puerto Rican statehood is that it should be left to Puerto Ricans to decide, not people here on the mainland. But for the first time, about 6 months after he won the DNC chair, Tom Perez came out and endorsed statehood. And then around that same time, after saying that the DNC would stay out of primaries, he endorsed none other than Cuomo for re-election to New York governor. You know, the first one we know was the quid pro quo. And the second one, we can look at the numbers and fairly assume it.
And, you know, we don't have time to go over all the, I mean, this is just a terrific book and really goes into so much detail about how this new populism on the left and democratic populism has really gone underway. So I'm just going to kind of ask you to summarize. You talk about Black Lives Matter, the climate emergency, the whole healthcare thing, the rise of the immigration movement, the rise of the women with the resistance movement. Can you talk about how these mass movements that often in the past typically have not really intersected much with electoral politics now have? And what are some of your thoughts on that and how that has, in fact, changed this landscape to the new kind of organizing that you talk about in this book?
Well, yeah, I think part of it is the Democratic Party getting cracked open and people seeing that there's actually a possibility for them to participate in Democratic Party politics and to drive the party in their direction. You know, for years, it didn't seem like to a lot of these social movements that there was much of a point in bothering because it was such a thoroughly, you know, kind of corporate captured, centralized operation. But you see things like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Squad for one. And then the other, you see these indivisible groups sprouting up all over the country who, you know, helped to flip a lot of seats and take back the House in 2018. And those organizations they're not beholden to anybody. And the people who were elected on the backs of that organizing, you know, very much understand that power now exists and could go a different direction or just not show up if attention isn't paid to the grassroots. So it's becoming a much more responsive party.
And finally, you end the book with a bang, I have to say. Your last words in the book are, quote, "Playing it safe is going to get us all killed." Talk about that.
Yeah, in that epilogue, which is the only place where I really kind of, I mean, you can tell me if you agree with this or not, but the book doesn't really, it obviously has a viewpoint, but it's not a sermon. It's not, I'm not giving you my opinion really on a lot of what's happening. I'm just kind of telling you the stories that maybe haven't been told a lot before. Whereas in the epilogue, that's much more like an opinion column. I'm telling you what I think. And I talk about the mid 1970s in the UK, where the Labour Party took power and people were furious. And there was a powerful left-wing element of the Labour Party that wanted to channel that anger into really democratizing the country and its economy in a radical way, to try to stem the tide of alienation and exploitation and collapse that was underway and that was tearing the fabric of the society apart. And they clashed with the moderate wing of the Labour Party, and the moderates eventually triumphed. And so they just did a few reforms here and there, did not satisfy people's anger. And so instead, Margaret Thatcher was brought to power, and Margaret Thatcher did not have the same moderate compunctions, and she delivered on what she promised. And so the point that I make in the epilogue is that there are a lot of risks to every political decision we make, and that we discount the risk. We underestimate the risk sometimes of not taking aggressive action, that you think you might be playing it safe, but in fact, you might be setting yourself up for something much worse.
Like climate collapse, for example. Well, Ryan Grimm, I just have to say, I learned so much from this book. It's got a ton of fascinating stories. We've got people from Jesse Jackson to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the end of big money and the rise of a movement. And thank you so much for a terrific interview.
Thank you.
If you've been watching the Democratic debates for the 2020 presidential primary season, it's become obvious that the divide between the left and the moderates now defines the field. That's something I spoke about with Nation editor Jeet Heer last week, a few days after the fourth Democratic debate. His editorial for the October 14th edition of The Nation was, "On a Crowded Stage, Democrats Divide into Two Tribes." Let's talk about the different fields that you write about in this article in On a Crowded Stage, Democrats Divide into Two Tribes. Tell us, who are the two tribes?
Well, I think the divide is between the left and the moderates. And obviously, the sort of leading figures on the left are Sanders and Warren, and the leading moderate is Biden. But what's interesting is that, you know, these are the sort of planets who have the real gravitational pull. And around these planets, you have certain satellites that are circling around. And what I find interesting is the way that the sort of second-tier candidates are choosing their sides. So you really see Castro not only taking strong left positions, but also often coming to the defense of Elizabeth Warren. And you see that with Booker as well. And, you know, conversely, on the moderate side, something like Pete Buttigieg is not only, you know, like on the moderate side, but maybe like attacking Elizabeth Warren in a way that helps Joe Biden.
Yeah. And you also point out that maybe some of these folks are also auditioning for a potential VP post.
Yeah, that's the only way I can kind of make sense of where Pete Buttigieg is at right now and what he's doing. And also Castro and Booker. I feel like they're trying to present the case. They place their bets. And they kind of make the case that they would be a good VP. And, you know, there is ways in which Booker would be a really good VP for Elizabeth Warren. So, yeah, I think that's what's going on.
And you also point out that Tom Steyer played a surprising role, although I think those who have been following him for a long time may not have been so surprised. I know I was more surprised that he actually got into the race rather than funding other people. But talk about Tom Steyer, and do you think he's going to be a spoiler?
Yeah, it's not surprising in the sense that if you know where he's coming from, but it is kind of surprising given who he is. I mean, he's the one billionaire on that stage. And, you know, when they quoted Bernie saying how the billionaire shouldn't exist, Steyer was like, well, Bernie is right. And so that is very surprising. I think it is surprising that, I mean, he's put in a lot of money to be on that stage. He spent like $46 million, which is almost equal to what Bernie and Elizabeth Warren have gathered so far. I don't know how much traction he's going to get, especially since there are like other more effective candidates. I think he has benefited from the fact that he was way ahead of the pack on impeachment, and people want to give him credit for that.
And so then on the moderate side, as you point out, that's led by Joe Biden. What did you think of Joe Biden's performance?
I thought this was actually his best debate. Unlike previous debates, especially the third debate, where he kind of said some very strange things, I thought Biden held it together. On the other, I mean, there were still problems. I think some of the ways in which he talked to Elizabeth Warren, you know, were really condescending and frankly sexist. But I mean, I thought he made, on the whole, a good case for himself. He, you know, presented himself as someone who has experience and who's electable. I think that's his best gambit, and he's sticking to it.
And yet he's raised far less money than Warren and Bernie. And
he's spending more money. I mean, that's going to be the big kind of issue. I mean, like, I think there's real kind of traps for him where he's not doing that great in the early states. And some of his staffers are already telling the media they don't expect to win the first three states. Well, you know, like, if he's doing poorly in the first three states and then, you know, voters pay attention, and he's going to look a lot less electable. He's not going to have a lot of money. It's kind of easy to see his sort of candidacy on a downward spiral. And the thing is, if he goes down, I'm not sure that there's a sort of moderate candidate who could replace him. Like, I think Pete Buttigieg is raising a lot of money, but he has so far shown no ability really to appeal to the sort of black voters where Joe Biden's based. So I don't know. It's hard to see Biden going very far, and it's hard to see anyone being able to replace him.
Yeah, and Pete Buttigieg also doesn't exactly get the working class vote.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, Pete Buttigieg's voters are really Warren voters. And so, yeah, it's hard to see him getting very far. One would think that someone like Kamala Harris could maybe appeal to some of those voters. And she did have her moment, but I think maybe she peaked too early.
Yeah, and you said that the voters who like Pete Buttigieg are also in favor of Warren. One problem that Warren does seem to have is that she doesn't have much of a base in the working class. Not, you know, for example, if you contrast that to Bernie. And when I say working class, I don't mean just white working class. I mean working class folks, lower income voters. Why do you feel that's true, since she's espousing many of the same populist platforms that Bernie is?
It really does come down to sort of like style and presentation. I think her language of she's got a plan appeals to middle manager types and, you know, the sort of what some academics call the, you know, professional middle class, what I guess people before used to call the wine crack. And it doesn't necessarily like resonate with working class voters the way that Bernie's more forceful and angry language does. And so I think that is a kind of problem. On the other hand, I mean, the one thing to remember is that, like, there's this always a bandwagoning effect and people like jump on board. Like, if you look at Barack Obama in 2008, his support with the working class, including the African-American working class, came late. It came after he won Iowa or did well in Iowa. So I feel like she could change this, but it is a real issue that there's a kind of technocratic aspect to her appeal that I think she needs to like broaden.
And then Andrew Yang is an interesting figure. You say that Yang's advocacy of the UBI, universal basic income, was more far-reaching than any other position on the moderate side, but it fell far short of Sanders' call for a federal job guarantee. Why did it fall short of that? You know, Yang was implying that the federal jobs guarantee fell short.
I think the basic issue with the UBI for me is that it's really coming out of Silicon Valley, and it's coming out of the people who have created the situation of inequality in a lot of ways. And it's a solution that disempowers people in a lot of ways. That, you know, you basically, everybody will, you know, receiving this basic income, but they won't necessarily be part of the economy except as consumers. Whereas like, if you have people have jobs, then they're like sort of functional members of society. And to be frank, I actually think that there's still like a lot of jobs to be done, you know, even with automation. And the whole claim that automation is driving job loss, I mean, it's disputed, but there's a lot of economists that go back and forth on this, and I really feel like it doesn't hold up. So UBI really feels like, it feels like a bread and circuses solution, a sort of top-down solution. And I think the federal jobs guarantee holds better in part because people want jobs. They want to have meaningful lives. They want to be participants in the economy and not just consumers.
And I think it's important also to clear up. Yang implied that these federal jobs would all be just through the federal government. But I don't believe that that's Bernie's plan.
No, that's right. That's right. Yeah, no, the federal job guarantee, which is a longstanding policy of like labor unions, it's like a push for full employment, not necessarily federal government jobs.
Right. And I'm also surprised, I wonder if you could weigh in, why does nobody ask Yang what I think is an obvious question, who can live on $1,000 a month if you don't already have a job?
Well, no, I think that's a good point. And actually, I mean, the fact that he brings up sort of like housewives as an example, maybe points to some of the problems. Like it is going to be a kind of supplemental income and maybe create a kind of dependent class. It seems like a very traditional, old-fashioned model that we don't necessarily want to go back to.
And now, one thing that has struck me in these debates is how much time is given to people who are not in the top tier, and thereby crowding out a real debate between, say, the nominees.
Yeah, we were not getting that debate between Biden and Warren and Sanders, and maybe like, you know, Mayor Pete and Harris that one would like. On the other hand, like, there's a value in having 12 people that they are bringing this stuff up. You know, like I'm not a big fan of Tulsi Gabbard, but I mean, she is bringing up a kind of extreme anti-interventionist position, which is good to kind of debate out. And the same with Yang. And actually, I found with Yang is very interesting. Like he raised a kind of point, which is a good point about the whole Russiagate matter, which is that the United States also interferes in elections abroad. And, you know, they might have to recalibrate its foreign policy if it wants to prevent future election interference. So I think there's a real value in having a really diverse ideological range of people on, and that they're bringing ideas to the fore that would not otherwise be there.
And so I'm going to ask you a final question, which wasn't really in your piece, but The Nation has run, and you know, you work for The Nation. The Nation has run a number of pieces, Katrina Vandenhuvel. I spoke with Dee Dee Guttenplan last week, with the idea that there should not be war between Sanders supporters and Warren supporters, just like there is no war between Sanders and Warren. I wonder if you could weigh in on just the dynamics of these two progressives whose positions, at least, that have been taken. I mean, there are clear differences between them, but they're clearly on the left side of the spectrum, progressive side.
Yeah, no, I sort of agree with the magazine's stance on this. I mean, there are differences, especially on, you know, like foreign policy, and I think on the environment. But I would like very much for Bernie to like really articulate those differences. But I mean, one thing to remember is that, you know, they were in the Senate together, and Sanders' closest ally in the Senate was Elizabeth Warren. But also, more importantly, his votes aren't necessarily going to come from Warren voters. Bernie's, you know, best shot at this is really to try to convince a lot of Biden voters who are like, you know, working class people to come on board his side. And so I think it's very interesting that you can have two very strong left-wing candidates that are appealing to different constituencies. And it really shows where the party is.
Well, that is so interesting. And Jeet here, thank you so much for talking with us here. Your article for The Nation is On a Crowded Stage, Democrats Divide into Two Tribes. Thanks again.
Great to be here. It's a very, very good conversation.
That was Jeet here of The Nation. His editorial for the October 14th edition of The Nation was On a Crowded Stage, Democrats Divide into Two Tribes. You can find more of that interview at writersvoice.net. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with NPR correspondent Aarti Shahani about her powerful memoir, Here We Are. It's about growing up as an immigrant in America. We also talk with Amitav Ghosh about his compelling novel about climate change, Gun Island. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.